I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. This past April, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf introduced a color-coded system, red, yellow, and green, to reopen the Commonwealth that had been locked down because of the coronavirus pandemic. As of last Friday, every county in Pennsylvania is in the green phase, meaning that most restrictions have been eased, but it's not back to normal by any measure. Pennsylvania Secretary of Health Dr. Rachel Levine has made mask wearing mandatory, meaning you must wear a mask or facial covering when you leave your home and you're out in public to stop the spread of COVID-19. We asked Dr. Rachel Levine to join us once again on Radio Times to explain, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, you can ask any kind of question you want, especially about mask wearing, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at phone number 1-888-477-9499. So masks are now mandatory in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Are there any exceptions, Dr. Levine?
Well, there are exceptions if individuals have significant medical conditions. So, for instance, seniors who might have heart disease, such as congestive heart failure, where they have shortness of breath, or perhaps lung disease, such as chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So we don't want people to suffer medical complications from masks wearing. And so that would be an exception.
I'm thinking about some of those really sort of basic responsibilities or routines of life, taking your dog for a walk, running to the, you know, to your car to go to the supermarket. Do we need to wear a mask under all circumstances when we're outside?
Well, you need to wear a mask if you're going to be in public. So if you are taking your dog out in your yard and there's no one there, then it's not necessary to wear a mask. But if you're taking your dog out to a public area and a park, and there's lots of other people there, then we want you to wear a mask. It's been very clearly shown that mask wearing can slow the spread of this respiratory virus, COVID-19, and so that's why it's of great public health benefit.
If you go out, you see all sorts of masks and bandanas and things that people are tying around their faces. What kind of mask should we wear to protect ourselves and obviously to protect other people?
So that's a very important point, is that primarily you are protecting other people by wearing a mask. So if you have COVID-19 and say you have very little symptoms or no symptoms, or you're going to develop symptoms several days later, you could still be contagious and the large droplets will be contained by your mask. So my mask protects you and your mask protects me. And if we're all wearing masks, then the whole community is protected. The best masks are really the cloth masks. There are a number of different ways that you can wear it, either, you know, or behind, so that the tags are behind your ear, or you can tie it behind your head. It should be at least 2-ply, meaning there are 2 layers, and those are very effective. The 1-layer bandanas are somewhat effective, but not as good as the 2-layer cloth mask.
And when you're talking about cloth, we're talking about things like cotton, you know, natural material like
that's
that?
That's correct. That's correct.
And I've also seen, I'm sure you have as well, Dr. Levine, people, you know, half wearing a mask. It's over their nose, but it's not over their mouth. This is sort of a very basic question here, but how much covering do we need to have?
Well, you need to cover your mouth and you need to cover your nose. And so, you know, sometimes we see people and it's covering their mouth, but their nose is left exposed, and that's not effective. So it needs to cover your nose and your mouth.
And things like washing hands and making sure we're 6 feet apart, just how important is that?
So all of those factors are very important, which is why in the daily reminders that I used to give, I would say them over and over again and never got tired of saying them, is really the biggest things the public can do is the mask wearing, staying 6 feet apart, washing your hands, and using hand sanitizer.
Governor Wolf was quoted yesterday at an event saying, I think he was asked, well, how long are Pennsylvania residents going to have to wear a mask? And he seemed to indicate until there is a vaccine. From your perspective, is that what we're looking for now?
I think that estimate would be correct. I think that until we have a safe and effective vaccine that has been able to be widely distributed, then the public is going to be at risk from spread of COVID-19, and it's very effective to prevent that spread by wearing the mask.
We have Charles calling us from Fort Lauderdale. I think he's on the phone, or perhaps this is a note. I'm not sure. I'm home and my staff is in Philadelphia, but he's asking about exercise and masks. Should people outside running and biking be wearing masks? Are there any risks to that? Dr. Levine?
So there are no risks to wearing a mask. Your body can handle this very well. You're not going to retain carbon dioxide. You're not going to have a lack of oxygen. Remember, you know, healthcare professionals, perhaps in an emergency department or intensive care unit or the operating room, have worn masks for hours and hours for many, many, many years. And so this is a well accepted practice. So if you're exercising and you're in public, so you're running in a park or on a trail where there's lots of other people. If you're riding your bike and on that trail and there's lots of other people, then you should wear a mask. If you're hiking in an area right outside your house and there's no one there, or you're on a trail in the middle of the woods and there's no one there, then you don't have to wear a mask. But if you're in public, please wear a mask.
I know some states, some governors are saying, look, if you're coming from a coronavirus hotspot, we either don't want you in our state, or if you come to our state, you have to quarantine for 14 days. Does Pennsylvania have a regulation on that?
So we have a recommendation. It's not an order or a regulation. But yes, if you are coming from states that are hotspots, so for example, Arizona, Texas, Florida, South Carolina, then and you come to Pennsylvania, then you should stay at home and quote unquote quarantine for 2 weeks.
You talk about recommendation. And my understanding with the mask mandate is that you're not going to have police arresting people. First of all, do I have that right?
So that is correct. The governor strongly feels, and I completely agree, that Pennsylvanians want to do the right thing and will do the right thing. And the right thing is when you're in public to wear a mask. If someone is not wearing a mask, then local law enforcement might remind them that they should wear a mask. But we're not intending to arrest people for that purpose. But it is a very important public health measure that is really the right thing to do and is protecting the public. You're protecting yourself. You're protecting your family, your neighbors in your community. And so we think people will comply easily.
And we've all seen videos of people refusing to wear masks. And sometimes it's people working in a restaurant or in a store that has to basically be the law enforcement when it comes to this issue. And it can get pretty ugly.
Well, we want all businesses to post that mask wearing is required when someone enters their business and to keep the mask on while they're in the business. It's great if stores can have some masks for people to give to them, a simple cloth mask if people don't have a mask, and to gently remind them. We don't want physical confrontations, however, in terms of someone not wearing a mask. We don't want anyone to get hurt.
Let me get Bill, and Bill is calling us from Fishtown. And Bill, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
I particularly care about this because I have someone at home that could die if they get sick. Mm. 4th of July, I saw the news, and it started with a bunch of feel-good stories about people all getting together finally and having fun. And then later in the news, they talked about you should wear a mask, but no instruction on really how. And when I was in first grade, I remember a story about a quarantine, and I understood the sense it made. It's not advertised. It's not people need to be educated. And I wish I had your faith in the people and the police reminding people, but most of the police don't even wear masks. And you walk
so
into a store
about
that says you got to wear a mask, the employees aren't wearing masks. A lot of them. And anyway.
No, I appreciate that.
Well,
absolutely. Bill,
well,
thanks
thank
for calling. Dr. Levine, go ahead.
We certainly want to get the word out to that. And that's why I have done, you know, countless interviews like this to tell people. All of the instructions are easily available on our website. And we have had many press releases about this and local officials reminding people, too. Philadelphia, we speak daily with Dr. Farley, the health commissioner of Philadelphia, to try to get that message across. We are doing the best we can from a public health perspective to get this message across. And we're hoping that people comply because they can prevent the spread of this very dangerous virus.
We have a tweet from someone who wants to know about reusing or washing masks. Are there things we should know about in particular?
So if you're using one of the masks that you buy where you have you don't reuse them, then you should throw them away. But if you have a cloth mask, you should wash it every day. And then you can use the mask again. So it'd be best to wash it every day.
There's a tweet from Dave says, I currently wear a 2-ply cloth mask with an N90 inside it with a face shield over that while doing Uber drives. Is the extra protection worthwhile or just a placebo?
No, I think the extra protection is worthwhile. Now, if you're using that type of mask, that's obviously very effective. We do not have the supplies to hand out those type of N95 masks and other face shields and personal protective equipment to the public. We have to distribute them to hospitals and healthcare personnel and also nursing homes and long-term care living facilities. But if the public does have that type of mask and is using a face shield, that is very effective in both protecting you and protecting the public.
How many new cases of coronavirus in Pennsylvania? I know you keep track and others keep track every day. Where do we stand today?
Well, we have seen an increase today. So new information is that we saw 995 new cases of COVID-19 in Pennsylvania. That's a significant increase. Much of that increase is because of delay in reporting from the holiday. So we do get what are called data dumps from cities and counties, as well as from the commercial laboratories such as Quest and LabCorp. And so today, I think, is higher because we had low rates over the holiday weekend because of delays in reporting. But we are seeing localized increases of COVID-19, particularly in the Southwest. And I would highlight the counties of Allegheny County, but also we're seeing increases in Westmoreland County and Washington County, Butler County, and Beaver County. So we're going to be working on that with our teams. We talk with the Allegheny County Health Department and Dr. Bogan every day, and we're going to be looking to prevent the spread, particularly right now in the Southwest.
And do we know why that spread?
You know, the evidence really is consistent with what we've heard in other states, is that it is younger people, 20s, 30s, say 40s, who are out and about. They are going to restaurants. They're going to bars. They're going to parties. They are not wearing masks. They're not social distancing, and they're not practicing the hand washing, et cetera, because the age range has gone down significantly in terms of all of those counties and in our reporting. So this is similar to the significant outbreaks that have been seen in Florida and Arizona and Texas, for example. And that's what we're seeing now. So we need to target our messages to young people. You know, they feel that they're sometimes that might be not going to be affected by this illness, but they can. And then they can transmit it to other people.
Well, we have to leave it there. Dr. Rachel Levine, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. She is Pennsylvania Secretary of Health, talking about the mandatory mask wearing in the state or the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. By almost any measure, the U.S. is losing its battle with coronavirus. While some states have been able to contain the disease, even reduce the spread, cases are spiking in many parts of the country with an estimated 50,000 new diagnoses a day. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, warned Congress last week that those numbers could double to 100,000. He spoke yesterday to Dr. Francis Collins. He's director of the National Institutes of Health, about the state of the current COVID-19 outbreak.
The current state is really not good in the sense that, as you know, we have been in a situation where we were averaging about 20,000 new cases a day, and then a series of circumstances associated with various states and cities trying to open up in the sense of getting back to some form of normality has led to a situation where we now had record-breaking cases. 2 days ago, it was at 57,500. So within a period of a week and a half, we've almost doubled the number of cases. So in answer to your first question, we are still knee deep in the first wave of this. And I would say this would not be considered a wave. It was a surge or a resurgence of infections superimposed upon a baseline, Francis, that really never got down to where we wanted to go. If you look at the graphs from Europe, the European Union as an entity, it went up and then came down to baseline. Now they're having little blips, as you might expect, as they try to reopen. We went up, never came down to baseline, and now we're surging back up. So it's a serious situation that we have to address immediately.
It's been more than 6 months since coronavirus was first identified, leading to more than 130,000 deaths in the United States. And while medical staff and scientists have a better understanding about how the virus behaves and how it damages the human body, we still have a ways to go to get control of the pandemic. We have two guests who have joined us for the rest of the hour here on Radio Times. John Wary is professor, chair of pharmacology, and director of the Institute of Immunology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. John Wary, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Jennifer Nuzzo is senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, also associate professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and she directs the Outbreak Observatory that does research to improve outbreak preparedness and response. And Jennifer Nuzzo, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We have a lot to talk about. Let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call us at phone number 1-888-477-9499. Jennifer, let me begin with you and those very sobering words from Dr. Anthony Fauci about the fact that we're not winning this battle, this war against this pandemic. Why is Europe doing better than we are?
No, we're really not. And I'm really glad he pointed out the discrepancy between the United States and Europe. I mean, just looking at what European countries have been able to achieve, that they've brought their case numbers way down and that they've been able to maintain that now while allowing themselves to go back to work and to open schools. When we compare that to what the U.S. is seeing, surging cases in more than half of U.S. states, struggles once again to conduct enough tests. We are very much not out of this, and in many respects, we're probably worse than we've ever been.
Is that a systemic problem, or is it just people are refusing to wear masks or wash their hands or keep their distance? I mean, we all saw pictures from the 4th of July weekend of about crowded beaches and people, you know, just living life as if there was no pandemic. If I can go quickly back to you, Jennifer, but John, I want to get you in on the conversation as well. Jennifer, go ahead.
Well, the challenge is that what we did was we shut down in March because we were seeing rapidly accelerated case numbers. And then a number of states just sort of, that's all they did. They just tried to battle the pandemic with executive order. But what we didn't do that other countries have done is develop the capacity to make sure we can do targeted interventions like testing, contact tracing, and isolating anyone who's infected or thought to be infected. But what now we're dealing with is that states have basically reopened with nothing in its place. And so the virus is still there. It's still circulating. We're still vulnerable. And when you have nothing in place, like the targeted public health measures, you're going to see the virus surge once again. Add to that, you also have leaders sort of openly questioning the existence of the virus or the need to take protective measures. And that just puts us in a very bad situation and really, I think, differentiates us from other countries that have taken this threat much more seriously.
John Wary, how do you see the state of the current COVID-19 outbreak?
Yeah, I agree completely with the idea that we have not put things in place for testing, contact tracing, and really many of the interventions that we've used in previous epidemics or outbreaks, even locally, have just not been implemented in a way to contain the virus. We've also seen, as I'm sure Jennifer can comment on more, really multiple different stages of outbreaks across the country where we had early events in New York and the Northeast, followed by events in the South, as we're seeing now. that have really led to multiple waves occurring in different populations that unfortunately, we really haven't learned from the early successes on the East Coast and implemented things and kept things implemented throughout the rest of the country.
John, what do we know about the virus that perhaps we did not know in, let's say, January, February, this past winter? How much more do we understand how it operates?
Well, we know a lot more. This is maybe the fastest that I've seen science move in my career to really target one problem. The early HIV epidemic was maybe similar in some ways. We now understand a lot about the virus, how it causes disease. We understand about vulnerable populations way more than we did. We knew the virus was a respiratory virus back in January, but what we didn't appreciate was how heterogeneous and how diverse the different outcomes can be in different people. We have people who are asymptomatic. We have people who have mild illness and spread the virus. We have other people that get extremely sick, have to be hospitalized, and the burden of hospitalized patients can really, really strain the healthcare system in general. And then we're also realizing that underlying comorbidities, underlying medical conditions can complicate the way this infection presents clinically and the management of that clinically. So people with underlying cardiovascular disease, obesity, diabetes are at a much higher risk for severe complications. Yet at the same time, we're seeing an increase in burden of infections and also disease in younger populations. That's quite concerning.
In fact, we were hearing from the Pennsylvania Health Secretary about the jump in cases in Pennsylvania, saying that young people seem to be more of a driver than they were in the past.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one of the interesting things here, so we often see this, each year with seasonal respiratory infections in the winter. And often it's children and the elderly, but children who really spread the infection around the community. Here it's actually looking, at least the trends are, that it's the 20 and 30-year-olds and maybe early 40-year-olds. And a lot of that may be behavioral, and as we're seeing, less adherence to some of the guidelines and masking and social distancing. But there may be other biological events occurring there as well that we don't understand yet.
I do want to pick up on that. Jennifer Nuzzo, let me go back to you, and let me talk to you about testing. I guess in a perfect world, would we test everybody? Then we would actually know. I know that's not possible. And then we would really get a handle on this virus and who's at risk?
Yeah, I don't really think that we would ever, try to test everybody. First of all, you could be tested today and be negative, and then be tested again tomorrow and be positive. So to think about doing that for everybody, I'm not sure that we could ever amass the resources we need to pull that off, like, healthcare workers and laboratories perform the tests. But what we very much should be aiming for that we're not even doing now is making sure that anyone who needs a test, someone, and there are priority groups there, that those priority groups can get tested. So clearly anyone with symptoms should be able to be tested. Someone who's been exposed to a known COVID case should be able to be tested. And people who work in very high-risk environments, I think there's some room for more regular testing of, those individuals as well. But that's not what we have yet even been able to achieve. So we know that in a number of the harder-hit states, first of all, people are waiting on lines for a really long time in order to be tested, and in some cases never getting tested because the kind of quota was reached. We also know that when people do get tested in many states, we're hearing about really disturbing delays in how long it takes to get their test results. And so if you get tested and you don't get your results back for a week or more, that's a very hard to use that test as a way to prompt public health action, like isolating people and to do contact tracing. So before we, sketch out these very bold goals that I'm not even sure are necessary, I very much want us as a country to do the necessities, focus on the highest priority groups first. And then once we are able to do that at the level we need, then we can talk about if we should further expand.
But what about the asymptomatic carriers, the people who don't have symptoms but would test positive if they did go to get a test?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important thing for us to think about how to test. And I think probably the way that we can better get at that is to do some more surveillance testing. But otherwise, it's really hard to know who you should test when and what day, and that's going to be difficult. Another thing that we have to do that's incredibly linked to testing but has very much been neglected is contact tracing. And that is when somebody tests positive, we need to figure out who they may have exposed and figure out who those people are, find them, let them know that they've been exposed, and tell them to stay home until we know for sure that they're not contagious. This isn't happening at the level it needs to. Other countries have been relying heavily on contact tracing. And the benefits of it are twofold. One, it helps us potentially get at some of those asymptomatic individuals and crucially reach them before they get to the point where they're contagious. So if they're already at home when we figure out that they are in fact infected and perhaps don't even yet have symptoms, then it's okay because they're not out and about reaching people. But the other benefit of contact tracing, which is very much still a benefit, even if we don't do contact tracing perfectly or at the level that we need, is that it helps us understand who is getting infected where. And that is something that we really don't still know in this country. If we can better figure out the environments where people are getting sick, then we can do more targeted interventions at preventing infections and potentially more targeted testing. So some places in the U.S. that have done contact tracing have found, in some instances in Michigan, they found 100 cases linked to a single bar.
Wow.
That's useful information that we should be collecting on the cases that we have so we know how to act.
Let me read a headline. This is from the New York Times, Carl Zimmer, on June 30th. The headline said, most people with coronavirus won't spread it. Why do a few infect many? And it's an article about what we call super spreaders. In terms of trying to understand this virus, who is vulnerable, who might be spreading it, how important is that, do you think, to understand these super spreaders?
Well, I think it's very important, and this is a phenomenon that we see occasionally in infectious disease, and you might recall sort of hearing stories about Typhoid Mary.
Yeah.
It's the same concept, although I would say that we still don't understand the biology behind it very well for most infections, and certainly not here for coronavirus. But it's really, really critical. Patients who get sick and really experience severe symptoms may be infectious to other people in that sort of pre-symptomatic phase, but that may only last for a few days. Patients who are asymptomatic, not feeling sick, but actually have a lot of viral replication in their lungs or especially in their nasal cavity will be spreading that virus around way more easily, way more often because they're not restricted in their behavior. And so it's probably a combination of underlying biological differences. We still don't understand very much about how the immune system controls the virus and what leads to states where you have viral replication but no disease, and also behavioral patterns where patients or people who feel quite well and are going about their daily activities have increased opportunities for spreading the virus. There may also be larger amounts of virus present in, air coming out of the nose and the mouth and, you know, other sorts of biological material that gets spread from person to person.
We got a lot of people that want to join our conversation. Let me get a couple of callers in. We've got Linda, and she's calling us from Bryn Mawr. And Linda, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there, Linda. Go ahead.
A couple weeks ago, can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. A couple weeks ago, I was talking to a total stranger from about 10 feet away. And as I adjusted my mask, he was not wearing one. And he said that he actually didn't need to because he had been hospitalized for the virus in April and had now recovered. And the antibodies in his system were a dead virus, so he no longer needed to wear a mask because he couldn't infect anyone. Is that actually true?
That's a very important question. I guess, John Murray, can I toss that back to you? But Jennifer Nuzzo, you probably want to add to that as well. For people who have contracted COVID and gotten out through the other side, are they contagious? Are they protected by antibodies? John Murray.
Yeah, so there are two parts to that question. So are they contagious? So once they've been released from the hospital, most patients will not be contagious, although there are examples of patients actually harboring virus for extended periods of time. Often they have underlying medical conditions. We don't understand them. So generally, that answer is probably yes, they're not contagious anymore, but there are exceptions. Now, do antibodies protect? If a patient has recovered from infection, are they now protected from being infected again? The simple answer is we don't know. We would like to think so. We would like to hope so. And evidence from the original SARS virus and a virus called MERS, that's very similar, suggests that antibodies can be protective. But in the case of this coronavirus, we actually have very little information so far. We do see that antibodies may wane in some people, although we're still, I think, waiting for more data on how to interpret that. So our hope for vaccines is that we're going to induce antibodies that protect us from infection. Whether those antibodies are truly protective is going to have to await vaccine trials where we actually get protection data. What we're seeing in patients who recovered, most of them, but not all of them, have antibodies, and some of them, those antibodies decline over time. Hmm. What we will learn over the next few months is how many patients that have recovered from infections now go back out into the community, actually experience a new infection because there's still virus in the community. There are emerging sort of anecdotes about this, but no true data to answer that question. So while that person who has recovered probably is banking on the fact that they're now immune, we actually don't really have strong data to make public health decisions about that yet.
Jennifer, almost up on a break here, but I mean, going back to the health commissioner of Pennsylvania, so wear a mask no matter what, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, important point. And regardless of, you know, how immune you think you are or whether you think you're at risk, you know, we're also trying to establish a norm here. We're trying to set the expectation that we wear masks in public. So if it were me and if I, with my, you know, expertise, was pretty confident that I was okay, I would still wear it because I want to send a signal that this is what we're doing as a community to protect each other.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jennifer Nuzzo. She's senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. She's also an associate professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and she directs the Outbreak Observatory, which does research to improve outbreak preparedness and response. John Wary's professor, chair of pharmacology, director of the Institute of Immunology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. We're getting an update on the coronavirus pandemic, and we are going to take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation, also get back to you, our listeners, callers, commenters. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with epidemiologist Jennifer Nuzzo and immunologist John Wary about what we have been learning about coronavirus, its effects on the body, and what it will take to get the pandemic under control. I do want to get back to our listeners. Jennifer, let me just put a quick question to you. In terms of testing, is there a risk for false positives, false negatives? And I wonder, as we get these state-by-state analyses of the numbers of cases, whether those are true, accurate depictions of what's going on in a state, whether antibody tests should be part of a diagnosis or not. I've tossed a lot of things at you, but help us better understand the pros and cons of testing.
Sure. So if you want to know if you have an active infection, what we use are viral tests. And no test is perfect. More frequently, we'd be concerned about false negatives, and those can happen for different reasons, possibly that you were just tested at the wrong time, or perhaps they didn't get the right specimen, or, you know, there might have been laboratory error. I haven't heard many reports of false positives, but there's always the possibility of that. That said, I think if you have a positive test result, particularly if you're not feeling well, you should very much act as though you have the virus and stay home. Antibody tests are a little bit more complicated. These are tests that are looking for evidence that you may have been exposed to the virus. And as the conversation earlier pointed out, we don't really know how these results translate in terms of your immunity to the virus. There's been a problem with the tests that are being used routinely in clinics, you know, kind of urgent care centers that are offering them. And I personally really do worry about the quality of the tests and whether they're giving accurate results. Mm-hmm. That said, there still is some use of these tests, particularly in hospitals when you have a very sick patient and they're testing negative, and perhaps they want to see if they're coming up positive on antibodies. But the antibody tests are not typically used to diagnose infection. And so I believe that they're of limited utility, except in the instance of very well-designed studies that, such as those being conducted by the Centers for Disease Control, that are trying to understand the prevalence of prior exposure to this virus. They're trying to answer questions about how many of us may likely have had this infection already, but it takes a very well-designed study in order to get results that we can try to answer that question with.
Let me get a couple of some callers back in, including Claudia, who's calling us from Mount Airy. And Claudia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, and thanks for doing the work you're doing.
Oh, thanks.
I am very concerned about the start of school. I have a daughter who's a teacher in the school system and a five-year-old granddaughter who's going to be in kindergarten for the first time. And I'm wondering why, if people aren't allowed to go in bars and restaurants, why can kids go back to school? That's part of my question. I understand the economic implications, and I hate it that the poor are suffering the most from the lack of getting to go to school. But I don't understand why they just, like, haven't considered, when they tell us you can't go into a bar, but 14 kids are going into a classroom, how do you feel about that?
Okay, fair enough. And my understanding, Claudia, is a lot of school districts are trying to figure this out. So while some may have made a decision, I think others are kind of waiting to see where the virus takes us. But nonetheless, it's a really important question. We're going to do a whole hour about it at some future date. But John Wary, let me hear from you about where you stand when it comes to kids and going back to school, and teachers as well, of course.
Yeah, thanks. I think this is an incredibly important question. I'll start off by saying one thing and then comment on the issue. I think we need to let the science and the data guide these decisions as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And the situation remains very fluid, and it's changing daily. I know a number of school districts, at least in my area, are, as you said, sort of withholding final decision until we have more information, we get closer to the time. I think that, you know, there's a difference between, you know, the behavior in bars and the behavior in schools. And, you know, I would sort of posit that one challenge with bars and environments like that is inhibitions are lower. And there's a feeling of, you know, this can't happen to me. Whereas in schools, you can, to some extent, depending on the grade level, you know, mandate certain behaviors or certain structure to the way things occur. I would also think that some school districts, and I know, are looking at alternate ways to provide education with a hybrid of online and in-person, or maybe shifts for different numbers of students. And, you know, the data is that kids are not showing up at hospitals as frequently as adults with this infection, something that I'll say we still don't really understand. So I would say that, you know, we have to protect our teachers. We certainly have to protect our kids. But just looking at the data, the risk in those populations for spreading for disease may be a little bit less than what we're seeing in the patrons of bars and restaurants.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Jennifer, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I do. A colleague, Josh Arstein, and I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times basically arguing open schools before we open bars. And, you know, we wrote this mostly, well, first of all, the American Academy of Pediatrics came out with a very sort of strong statement of the need to send kids back to in-person learning, in viewing the risks to kids and, you know, the benefits of in-person learning. They concluded that the benefits exceeded the harms. And so it's true. I mean, we are operating from a place of lower risk when we're talking about kids in schools. But low risk does not mean no risk. And, you know, I think there are a number of steps that schools can take to further reduce the risk of spread of the virus. And so that's things like spacing kids in classrooms and limiting the amount of interactions of kids, you know, possibly kind of keeping a bubble of children that only interact with each other. And, you know, there are just a number of steps, and we outline it in the op-ed, of things that can be put in place. But, you know, these are measures that school districts will need help with, and it will take a lot of planning and, frankly, resources. And one of the concerns that we've had is that the amount of attention to this issue has not been sufficient, and the amount of support given to schools in order to think about how to safely bring kids back into the classroom, which frankly is really important, not just for their education. I mean, I think people just sort of assume kids can do it all on computers, but in-person education and the socialization is important for their development as well. And we frankly should be giving this issue much more attention. It's not just about economics, it's about our kids' futures.
Well, and kids is all, I mean, learning is all about socializing and interactions with other people. It's such a personal experience. Daniel asks, are there effective apps for contact tracing that people can sign up to help the effort? Jennifer, are there things like that? Citizen contact tracers?
Yeah, so there are a lot of different apps that have been proposed, and I know different jurisdictions are pursuing different sorts of approaches. I very much think that if contact tracing programs are going to use apps, that they have to be the ones to kind of help create the apps that they're going to use. That said, one thing that I'm really interested in is an approach that New Zealand has taken. One of the problems with apps is that sometimes they basically give you way too much information and not necessarily actionable information. So if you use a location-based approach, it might identify people that you've had, you know, that were within 20 feet of each other, but that's not necessarily meaningful from a from an exposure standpoint. But New Zealand has very much encouraged people to sort of keep a diary of where they've been, because people forget. You know, if someone asks you, where have you been for the last 2 weeks, you know, chances are you may really struggle to remember. But they've also recruited businesses in the work of contact tracing. And so businesses, in order to stay open, basically created like logbooks for their patrons so people could sign in so that they know who was there when. They also created these posters that patrons could kind of scan with a QR code so that they could create a record of having been there. And people don't have to share that information with the government. They only share it if they want to. But, you know, it helps them remember all the places that they've been, and it cuts down on the workflow of contact tracing. And I think those sorts of approaches are really helpful, where we sort of don't have to worry about privacy because it's voluntary, but also don't have to worry about sort of overwhelming the contact tracing teams with too much information that's not actionable.
John, we have an email. Are people with blood type A at higher risk for complications from COVID-19? And in doing my homework for the show today, I ran across an article that referenced that. In terms of our understanding of the virus, is that helpful?
Yes. I mean, that's the data. I will say that we don't understand it, but that's been confirmed now by multiple groups. And we see that same thing at the University of Pennsylvania. We're not exactly sure why. There may be underlying genetic associations that involve something related to the blood group and not exactly the blood group. It could also have to do with some cardiovascular relationships and some immunological mechanisms by which A blood type people get more complications than O blood type people. But this highlights sort of the complexity of this infection and the need for just continued science to understand it. Those are the kinds of data that are emerging from our practical experience treating people, and they're clues that we should be able to use to develop better therapies to, you know, make sure that we can treat people who are very sick and perhaps better preventative approaches, including vaccines.
Let me read an email from Beth, and Jennifer, I'll toss this to you. She says, the reason we are seeing an upsurge in virus cases because so many Americans are selfish and myopic, not even considering how their careless actions could affect others, makes me furious, but it certainly doesn't surprise me. As for my part, I will gladly stay home and protect myself and my loved ones for as long as it takes. It's an emotional, it's a powerful damnation, really, of a lot of response in the United States, whether it's people who don't believe that it's as dangerous as it is. Our president, President Trump, said that 99% of cases are, quote, totally harmless. Can you just kind of speak to this more political moment that we're in?
Yeah, I think it's a really challenging situation when we have our nation's leaders basically openly question the harms that this virus is causing and the need to protect ourselves. You know, if that's a leader you trust and admire and are getting your information from, then, you know, you can understand why they might not feel compelled to protect themselves. And that's really, I think, a worrisome situation. I mean, you can't do nothing to stop this virus, but if you're not even going to acknowledge the need to take protective measures like wearing masks and trying to avoid crowded spaces, then we're in a really difficult situation. Mm-hmm. That said, I mean, you know, first of all, not all of us can protect ourselves. And I think that's something that we also have to acknowledge. If the primary means of protecting yourself is staying home, not everybody has that luxury. Some people absolutely have to go out and work and they don't have the ability to, you know, keep 2 weeks of groceries on hand or whatever other strategy some of us are able to employ. And then also, it's really hard. It's hard to stay cooped up. I completely understand. You know, it's probably easier for some folks than others based on personality or living circumstances. And so I do think that rather than shame people who go out, I think we should try to figure out how to provide lower risk activities for people, like, you know, outdoor spaces so that they can be out and about and think about how to reduce risk in spaces as much as possible.
Joan Wary, I'm looking at the clock here, and I'm just curious about sort of the state of vaccine research. Where are we? And I know the timetable, depending on who you talk to, can be by the end of the year, a year from now. Where are we as you understand it?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I think it's really important. So we have a large number of vaccines in trials. Last I checked, there were 10 or more different vaccines already in trials in people to assess what we call their immunogenicity. That is, does the vaccine induce the kind of immune response that you want? And many of them are actually getting accelerated progression through the stages of clinical trials. So people often ask, there are two questions. One, are any of these vaccines going to be protective and actually work? Right. We very effectively made vaccines against the original SARS virus and the related virus called MERS in 15, 20 years ago, and never needed them. So for related viruses, we've been very successful making vaccines that are protective. The second question is, why does it take so long? And that's either because the science isn't there, the regulatory environment makes it too difficult, or the actual trials take that long. And so the science is there. Based on the previous experience, we can make vaccines that should work. The FDA and regulatory bodies have been incredibly flexible while being safe to move this faster than anything moves in the vaccine setting before. So it's not the regulations. It's actually that making a vaccine just takes a long time. And that's for two reasons. We've made vaccines before that instead of protecting, actually can cause some harm. There was a vaccine for respiratory syncytial virus in the early 1970s that made children actually more sick. Yeah. The other reason is you just have to wait for people to get infected. So you have to know when you vaccinate someone or you have a control group, they have to get exposed in the community, and then you have to see whether your vaccinated group got infected more or less than your control group. And there's no way to accelerate that process. If you vaccinate 1,000 people, you just have to wait till some of them start getting exposed and are either protected or not. And that can take, you know, months, sometimes years in some cases. I'm optimistic that we will have a vaccine, at least a first vaccine, early in 2021.
Well, that's good news, I think. I hope. And we have to leave it there. Joan Wary, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. He's chair of pharmacology, director of the Institute of Immunology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Jennifer Nuzzo, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She's senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and associate professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and she directs the Outbreak Observatory. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.